Our thanks to John for his songs that he's led us in this morning. I'll get this thing fixed up here so you can hear me. We welcome everybody again. If you're a guest with us here today, we so thank you for the encouragement of your presence. For those of you who are back with us for the first time in a while, it's so good to see you. And for all of you who have been standbys, presence for all of us, we're grateful to see you as always, and we thank the Lord for you. Are you an observer of the culture around very much? Do you pay any attention to the big events or to the current events or to the ways in which our society generally thinks and speaks and acts? If you are, I have a question I'd like to begin with this morning for all of us. Does it seem to you that the societal approach, generally speaking, the societal approach to self-fulfillment is leading to self-respect in the people who are pursuing self-fulfillment? There's a lot of self in that. Maybe that's a part of the problem. The approach, generally speaking, it looks to me like at least, is to demand that history be guilty and that outcomes be equal and that lifestyles be affirmed, though remarkably, how we behave is supposed to be irrelevant. But what people seem to come out of it with is not self-fulfillment. It looks like people come out of it as if ready to feel respected at the drop of a hat, at any slight, enraged by any dissent with their own view of things, and willing to hurl the most hateful invectives at offenders of themselves, hateful things that they would regard, if said to themselves, as being expressions of the most vile kind of hate. I'd say that people don't look very secure, really, and that's not exactly the demeanor you'd expect of people who are infused with self-respect because they've demanded respect from the world around them. I think the gospel offers quite a different ethic for self-fulfillment. The gospel calls us to be honorable. Now, a couple of thoughts here that I'll mention before we go on. Remember last week we offered an ethic for, or we observed in Scripture, an ethic for a civil society, which is be holy, be as God is in the world. And then I might mention that by ethic we mean a set of moral principles to be used in life. We're not suggesting that godliness or that what we're talking about occurs, that our faith is just about morality. But because our faith starts with who the Lord is and what He's done, there'll be a set of principles that guide us. So what Romans 12 and 13 call us to do, in Romans 12 and 13, there is the beginning made at chapter 12, verses 1 and 2, and then the loop is closed at the end of this chapter, and in between, at chapter 12, verse 17, for example, we're called to take thought for things that are honorable in the sight of all men. ESV says, take thought to do what is honorable in the sight of all men. Other translations will say, what is noble, or what is right, or what is good. And then later on, down at verses 12 and 13 and 14, some of the versions translate one of the words honorable again. So here's a way that according to the New Testament, that'll not only serve you well in society and your dealings with people, but also it'll give you a self that you can live with and a self that will turn you into a blessing around the people that you love the most. I guess the question that comes to mind is, and it's an important question, if you think about it, if we're to take thought for the things honorable in the sight of all men, or as the New American Standard puts it, if we're to respect what is right in the sight of all people. How do you do that in a world where nothing seems to be right in the sight of all people? That's a pretty high calling, isn't it? And the answer is in this call here, be honorable. That's the idea the New Testament gives to us. In the Christian view, being honorable boils down to the passage that we're going to notice at the end of Romans chapter 13. Being honorable is not an undertaking which is begun out of pride and which results in conceit. Being honorable is not an exercise which expresses failure and results in self-loathing or false humility. Being honorable is the approach that comes from trying to walk in the footsteps of Jesus Christ. It's not just honor in the sight of people that we're talking about, but honor within ourselves as persons. It's response to God and not a reaction to the world's flaws, either past or present. And it's through Christ. It's not through anybody's or because of anybody's feeling of superiority over other people around them. And what I'd like to call your attention to with our text today is that this comes from a gospel point of view, and it leads to a godly course of actions. Those are the two big parts of our thoughts today. A godly point of view, and then, or a gospel point of view and a godly course of action. Let's start with the point of view that comes from the gospel. Really, the word in Romans 13 that this whole text starts from or builds upon is the word in our passage last week that we finished with. And I know some of you didn't get to be with us last week, but we read from Leviticus 19, and where we ended was verse 18. And that verse said, "You shall love your neighbor as yourself." And if you'll notice, Romans 13 and verse 9 cites that statement at the end of the verse there and applies it in the Christian life. Over there in Leviticus, it was about holiness in our interaction, socially speaking, with other people. But here, it's also about honor in ourselves as Christian people. In between Leviticus and here, Jesus has said that this is the second great command. As Justin mentioned with the youngsters a while ago, Jesus said that in Mark 12 in verse 31, as I think you guys very well know. And this is a passage here in Romans 13 which explains to us why that is, why that can be thought of as such a great command or a great statement to us. Now, a little bit about the framing of this that helps, I think, how we look at this. What's changed in between Leviticus 19 and Romans 13 is the perspective from which the gospel allows us to look at this call to love our neighbors as ourselves and to take the whole thing in. Over there in the Old Testament, it was a law that made all of us see our need for mercy if we really thought about it. Because who could say, "I have done this completely"? But over here, it's an appeal that's based on the mercies that we've already been given by God's grace in Christ, as Romans 12:1 said. Back over there, it involved sacrificing a peace offering which had to be shared and eaten within 2 days. But over here, it's presenting our bodies as a living sacrifice given to the Lord daily from now on. Over there, it was about not profaning what is holy to the Lord. But here, it's about discerning what's good and acceptable and perfect and what's the will of God, not just what's holy to Him. Over there, it was because the people had been brought out of the land of Egypt. Here in Romans, it's because we've been set free from the law of sin and death, as Romans 8 and verse 12 said. Over there, it said over and over again, I am the Lord your God. But here in Romans, what is said is because you are Christ's. You are the Lord's. Because Christ died and lived again that he might be Lord of both the dead and the living. So the point of view in this whole passage is fashioned by what Christ has done for us by the will of God, and what we have been given through the mercies of God, and what's possible for us in that way, or because of that. Now, with that perspective, that gospel point of view, Paul calls for a godly course of action. This is his approach to honor. And I want to try to make a more complicated passage much more simple, at least for my feeble mind to take in, with just three principles here that are called for. This is the way of honor. First, love the other, verses 8 through 10 in Romans 13. And I looked it up. I read this somewhere, and I checked it for myself. When it says, oh, no one in anything except to love each other, for the one who loves another has fulfilled the law. It doesn't say neighbor, as in these passages. It says love the other. The other person, the other sex, the other color, the other social status, the other family member, the other church member. Love the other, not merely yourself and all of those who are exactly like you. To love like this, says Paul, is the debt that each of us will always owe. And one of the old commentators said, this is the one debt which none of us will ever repay, and which everything we do pay will only be the interest. And the idea when this text says, for the one who loves another has fulfilled the law, That's what he's getting at. God has loved us, as we've remembered this morning. There's no way we can ever repay that in the lives of other people, but we can pay the interest, the overflow of it to other people. And the text goes ahead to say, this is what the commandments have been telling us. The commandments have been telling us how to begin loving. Our problem often is we run into the idea that loving is what we just normally do, and it's a warm, fuzzy feeling, and we forget probably that God, it'd be hard for God to feel warm and fuzzy about us when we were his enemies, and when he was offering his son to try to get us back. The text says in verse 9, for the commandments, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not covet, and any other commandment is summed up in this word, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. If you think that when we talk about love and our obligation to love our neighbors or ourselves, we're talking about something easy or just a feeling, please take another look at this text. It doesn't say the law ends with this. It says the law is fulfilled in this way. So the way to train ourselves to love and to begin to love involves the kind of behavior which says, I will respect another person and not exploit another person. I won't commit adultery. I will care for the life of another person and not hurt the life of another person. I won't murder. I will do what's good for another person and not take what belongs to another person. I won't steal. I'll dwell on gratitude and not discontent. I won't covet. That's the kind of thing that heads us down the road toward loving. It's not easy, simple, gentle stuff. It's the hard moral work of disciplining ourselves in life. I read something that British scholar N.T. Wright observed about love, which I think might be thought-provoking for us. He said, whereas the early Christians understood that love had been modeled on what Christ himself had done and given himself up for us, we face the practical problem of giving lip service to the idea of love when we don't usually stop and reflect on how to do it. And he says this, granted the prevailing context of romanticism, that is, we fall in love, and what he calls existentialism, meaning we exist and we're who we are and we have technology and so forth, it's normally assumed that love will just happen as long as people are sincere and do what comes naturally. But Wright says, the moral history of the 20th century should have given the lie to this. But since it's a convenient thing to believe, giving a person the feel of virtue without the need for hard moral work, the belief continues unabated and is propagandized in popular culture. And Wright says this, we urgently need the moral reflection at every level of church and society on what exactly love is and what it means and doesn't mean, and more especially the steps of moral learning and effort required to attain it. If we want our children to learn to love, we teach them, don't commit adultery, don't murder, don't steal, don't covet, don't bear false witness. There has to be a way to learn how loving action is expressed and how it takes place. Paul goes ahead to say then in verse 10, love is the fulfilling of the law. It not only does good to the other person, but it does no harm to the other person. A part of the task of loving given too little attention to is not doing harm to or not bringing hurt to other persons who may be around us. One of the writers that I've noticed and have appreciated pointed out the commandments that Paul lists here in Romans 13, verse 9, are calculated to remind us that not acting this way does harm people. Murder robs them of their life, adultery of their home, theft of their property, false witness of their good name, and covetousness robs society of the ideals of simplicity and contentment. Maybe that helps to see kind of what Paul is getting at here in this passage, and to remind us that loving the other is a start toward an honorable self and a society characterized by respect. Secondly, Paul says, know the time. A lot of you know the time of day right now. I can see you. check that. Know the time. That's not what he means, the time of this day. He says, the hour has come for you to wake from sleep. This is in verse 11. And he's talking about moral stupor or inattention about how life is lived or unconcern about the direction in which things go. I think we can visualize what Paul means by contrasting a couple terms that are used in the New Testament, this age and the age to come. When Jesus looked at reality in Mark 12 and verse 32, he spoke of this age and the age to come. Back up in chapter 12 of Romans here in verse 2, when it talked about this world, literally, it's this eon or this age, and it contrasts with the time when the Lord comes and when our salvation is complete. So a lot of times this passage here in Romans, the debate goes, is this talking about the destruction of Jerusalem? Is this talking about the end of one's individual life? Is it talking about the day of judgment? What is it? And a good way to think of it would be to think of this age, which is passing away, versus the age to come when our inheritance is fulfilled. The New Testament teaches us that Christ gave himself to deliver us from this present evil age. And yet we're called to live in this present age, waiting for our blessed hope, which is the appearing of the glory of Christ. I've just mentioned Galatians 1:4 and Titus 2, verses 12 and 13. This present age is passing away, but the new age, which has already dawned, won't turn into the new day until the coming of Christ. That's the idea. The song about the king who's coming, or watching and praying or being ready for him, was from that idea. So it's as if Paul is suggesting that we think of ourselves as living in a limited period of time. The period of time between when the first light of dawn begins to show and the sunrise occurs. The gospel has caused the first light of dawn to begin to show with the resurrection of Christ. And the full light of day happens whenever, with the coming of Christ, his people are raised up. So Paul is saying to us, since that's when we live, since you know that's the time where we as Christians live, then remember how critical the moment is. Be awake and dress for the day. Don't be acting like it's evening and time to turn in again. I ran into something working on this, which a fellow wrote in 1985. And I thought, he was either a prophet. Most people, if I read this now, would think he's talking about us. He was discussing what happens when we lose sight of the fact that the Lord will come again and that there's a day of reward and of judgment ahead of us. And if we start acting like that won't occur, if that's not even on our minds again, he says that what happens to us is we start acting like everything that we see is wrong, we have to fix ourselves. And then he says this. What happens when people start doing that? The self-righteousness of those who believe that unless they do the good, it can never be done is a fearful thing. Much of the vilification visited by social reformers on those who do not fully support, let alone upon those who question their programs, is the result of their feeling that unless their version of societal reform is enacted, no redemption will ever occur. Such hostility toward those who disagree with their program for goodness bears eloquent testimony to the outcome of such self-idolatry, which occurs with the loss of hope in God's future. We are seeing around us signs of the loss of hope for God's future. The writer was Paul Ochtemeyer. He says, but unless the love is tempered by the hope of God's final redemption, It'll turn into an instrument of ideological tyranny and fearful self-righteousness. I don't think I have to argue the relevance of that kind of statement. Love the other, know the time, and then Paul says, live the day. And again, he's not just talking about living this one day, which is not bad advice in itself. Jesus taught it. But live as if you belong to the day, and live as if you would if out in the full daylight everybody could see and everybody was watching. Do what you dressed up to do when you became a Christian and put on Christ. The cloak of darkness isn't the appropriate thing for you. Now wear the armor of light. Look at verse 12. The night is far gone, the day is at hand, so then let us cast off the works of darkness and put on the armor of light. Let us walk properly as in the daytime, he says. The phrase walk properly as in the daytime is to walk becomingly, some versions will translate it, or to live honorably, one says, or to behave with decency, another translates it. In my phrase, it's what John means by walking in the light. And that excludes some things that Paul is clear about. He says, not in orgies and drunkenness, verse 13. Not in the kind of situation where by use of substances a person dulls his senses to where the wild carousing and the partying and the loss of dignity all occurs. Not in sexual immorality and sensuality. Sensuality is, Barclay said, is the ugliest word in the New Testament. Whereas love meant you don't exploit. This is a way of behaving which uses people and casts them aside. And it's a way of acting in which the person loses any interest in what his actions look like to other people. Just simply is an animal in pursuit of animal impulses, not personal relationships. And then not in quarreling and jealousy. One writer said, four out of five churches would be highly offended at the presence of the first two pairs of these sins, but readily accepting of the third pair. I hope that's not the case. No venom of spirit. And the idea that Paul is getting at is simply be as Christ is in this age. Remember last week, be holy. Be as God is in the world. Be honorable is be as Christ is in this age. Paul says, put on the Lord, verse 14, and make no provision for the flesh to gratify its desires. The flesh is the part of any person which might possibly have some attraction for orgies, drunkenness, sexual immorality, sensuality, quarreling, and jealousy. Don't provide a place in your life for those things to grab hold of you and take hold of you. That's what this is saying to me. And that would be a way to move toward honor in ourselves. This is how Christians view things, the world in which we live. There are mercies in the past. There is hope in the future, and there are people now. McGarvey and Pendleton, in their old book on the epistles, said that in this text, the spiritual forces of memory and hope are made use of by the apostle to push and to pull his readers heavenward. The spiritual forces of memory and hope. And his people, those people, that people, are those in Christ. And they're the people who are to love the other, to know the time, and to live the day. And that's an approach that will lead to personal fulfillment, because Christ has gone ahead of us as a forerunner, and because it arises from the care he's already shown for us, it'll give self-respect along the way. And our purpose today is to try to encourage all of us to be going in that way. And remember, we're invited to turn around and go in that way if that hasn't been our direction. And to remember that we can help each other to do that. And to encourage us to do that this week. If you're a person who has been wanting to confess the name of the Jesus, the Christ in whom you believe, and to be united with him in the baptism, and to walk with him in the light, you've been looking for an occasion. If we can help you in that way this morning, be our pleasure. And remember, you can do this anytime. We're available to help you if we can. And let's pray for each other in being honorable in this new week. If we can help you, let us know by coming while we stand and sing together.